This podcast is proudly sponsored by David Robago Family Chiropractic. We fondly refer to our chiropractor as Dr. Dave, who is an ambassador of good competition and an active member of our jiu-jitsu community for the past 10 years. For sports injuries, think Robago Chiropractic, where soft tissue injuries respond quickly with chiropractic care so you can keep on training. Dr. Robago is conveniently located near Arden Mall at 1860 Howe Avenue, number 435. Give him a call at 916-568-6333 so you can give it your all on the mat. And don't forget to tell him Gibran sent you. The newly crowned King of Tokyo. Back from competition with the gold medal at the Tokyo Games.
Yeah, it
was really with IBJ. That's an IBJJF tournament.
It was
very cool. So is that? And you were just telling me that's your first time heading out to Tokyo.
First time heading to Tokyo. It had been a huge bucket list thing for me personally since I was a kid. You know, like
yeah.
I think any martial artist can that resonates with any martial artist because you know of the Orient kind of being the origin of a lot of what we recognize as martial arts nowadays. So man, it was a crazy dream to realize, you know, to be there. I was super pumped to be there.
That is so cool. It looks like you were out there for a little bit.
So a week.
Like a week?
Yeah.
That's so cool,
week,
man.
A solid week. But, it, you know, it's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
It was not enough. So I thought this was going to be my last hurrah. I was never going to be able to go back. And I'm already looking at going back in September for the Asian Open. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Find a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
Very cool. So when you do those competitions abroad, man, there's so much to unpack there. What'd you see out there that like really stuck with you?
Man, so we were staying in Shinjuku and Shibuya, which are known to be the most transited metro stations in the world.
Okay.
And so
this is like north, south, what island were you on?
I was in Tokyo.
Okay.
So Tokyo proper. I never really took off out of Tokyo proper. And unfortunately, again, like there was like hot springs and like I didn't get to see Mount Fuji. I didn't get to see a bunch of like the real big touristy spots.
Okay.
But it was enough for me just to try to get a grasp of what I was seeing, right?
Nice.
And that in and of itself it's really hard to attain, especially for West, you know, people that are westernized and whatnot. And man, I think the biggest thing for me was like everything that I had recognized as human behavior, right? Like, again, I'm Puerto Rican and I travel the world. I consider myself cultured. Yeah. I noticed similar mannerisms and ways of talking, eye engagement, things like that.
Sure.
Completely different.
Everything's different over there.
Everything was completely different for me. And it's like really fascinating.
Man, I mean, you think about, you know, Puerto Ricans are, you know, you guys are warm-blooded people. You guys are.
Or Latinos in general.
Latinos in general, right? But I mean, you guys are... You know, you laugh, you talk loud, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so I spent some time on the East Coast.
Talk abrasively.
Yeah, but you know, whatever. You're just communicating. Yeah. That's how you talk, right? I couldn't think of a more distinctly different culture than the Japanese, right?
Yeah.
Like everyone's understated. My wife went to Japan earlier this year with her family. She's telling me there's no trash cans, but you can't find a piece of litter on the floor.
That's right, yeah. Exactly. So you're walking the streets and you can't find a damn trash can. And but I mean,
what is that?
Obviously, people are consuming. So where does it go?
Yeah.
And I was talking to my buddy who went with me, Rich, and the deduction that we came up to was that look, they must force the issue. I mean, it must be a logistical thing, right? They must force the issue about taking the trash home with them, so that way, you know, it's logistically easier just to take care of the garbage in the residential
like less points of contact and...
over like having garbage in your cities, right?
Yeah.
And man, I'm talking about transited cities. Like Akihabara was like electric district, hundreds of thousands of people walking through there every day. You don't see a cup on the floor.
Wow.
Right? We were on the river in Tokyo River. We did that kind of a tour. Not a cup in the water, not a piece of styrofoam, nothing in the water. It seemed clean. If I didn't know about the nuclear disaster, I would have thought otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
But dude, nothing.
No, you want to hear something crazy about Fukushima? So, you know, because I worked for the state of California and I worked in the legislature.
Okay.
And so a lot of my assignments were environmental. And so this is crazy. The earthquake that hit Fukushima dislodged a pier from the beach. And that pier, over the period of like a year and a half, floated up the Alaskan Gulf.
Okay.
and then down and landed on the shores of California.
No shit.
And it had a bunch of like barnacles and crazy like invasive fish species that we're still dealing with today.
Wow.
Because, you know, like in ecology, right? Like everything's for the most part supposed to stay in its own little area, right? Yeah. Well, we got
compartmentalized kind of.
Because like, you know, the prey and the predators and the food pyramid that they have over here might not work for what they have in another area, right? So that's what we really got. Like the radiation, you know, people are really scared of it because it's radiation, but by most accounts,
it's still exposed from what I understand. Yeah. They don't have it contained.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, how are you going to contain it? It's radiation.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You got to leave.
Yeah. You're going to have to bounce sooner or later. That's going to be a really big issue.
Yeah.
Right? Like now I think they're doing a lot of covering up of what's going on, but I had read some stuff earlier on this year, February, that it's still, it's still a problem.
Well, what we definitely got was these fucking invasive barnacles.
Yeah. So those things made their way out this direction.
Yeah.
And any fallout from the invasive barnacles?
Yeah, no, the Department of Fish and Wild, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is like really having an issue with them.
No shit.
Yeah. It's a real problem because they come in and they'll fuck up like the barnacles that we do have here in our own ecosystem. So it'll fuck up
what we have
currently. Yeah. If you imagine, because that's the bottom of the pyramid, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So if you fuck up the bottom of the pyramid,
the base,
there goes the rest, you know? We really struggle with a lot of like invasive species in California.
Do they behave differently? Like characteristics?
I think they like outcompete what we have here for the same food resources, but they don't do what we want them to do. Like typically those like barnacles clear the water and filter the water.
Okay.
Which is why like if you go to like Marin County, they have oysters out there.
Yeah.
And it's like really blue, clear water. It's because the oysters are filtering all those toxins out of the water. You know? So
I just thought it was all the money in Marin County.
They found a way to keep the water clean.
I just thought there was something going on.
Oh man, I'm gonna get out there to Marin County actually pretty soon. It's beautiful camping.
So I go, I have a cousin who lives up that direction.
Okay.
Javier, he's like my brother. And he moved out there for better job opportunities and to be with his significant other. And I visited a couple times, man. Lots of money. Great houses and stuff like that out there.
Yeah.
You know? Like very beautiful vistas.
Yeah.
And phenomenal food. I'm a bit of a foodie.
Are you really?
Yeah. By foodie, I mean glutton. So foodie, yeah. So Marin's got great food, man. Great food. Great place to be for that.
Yeah. So the Coast Highway, you can take it all the way up to Jenner, and there's like great little food stops. Like, oh, look, I just caught the salmon. You know, why don't you come have a piece? It's awesome, man. People don't realize like how much just beautiful diversity there is in California, man. My wife and I went camping yesterday to Mineral Bar. It's in Auburn.
Auburn. Okay.
Yeah, it's like the bottom of this valley in Auburn. It's the North Fork of the Sacramento River.
Okay.
And you kind of have to do this like – almost like this like four-wheeling drive type of course down this like kind of steep ravine, and you camp at the bottom of this valley. And so it's a valley, there's two sides. So we thought, hey, what the heck, we'll try and leave up the other side of the valley, you know? And on the other side of the valley, man, people were not well, man. It was like the Confederate flag, State of Jefferson type of people. There's like no fucking power out there. There's like no toilets. Everyone's like crapping in an outhouse.
Explain why they're still rocking the Confederate
flag. Yeah. They're just living in the past. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they're like, I mean, they're like one step away from homelessness, you know? And they're like,
if they're rocking that flag,
they should be. Yeah. But it's just kind of like,
they're political, but they can fuck themselves.
They can fuck themselves. Yeah. I agree. But they're like, you know, they're like, kind of like, I hope no one takes what little piece of whatever I have is mine. Well, what do you have? You have a tent.
Yeah.
You look homeless. You know what I mean? Yeah. But let me tell you, man, that area is just gorgeous, man.
But to each their own. That's what they're entitled to. That's what they want. Then I respect that. You know, give them their space. Let them die amongst the sticks. That's
good. Yeah. But yeah, man, just California. Like that was my first camping trip of the season with the wife.
Like, you go camping. Camp?
Yeah, we try to. Okay. We try to. We got one of those tents that like kind of like.
My wife is killing me to go.
Yeah, we got one of those tents that sit on top of the car and they just kind of come out like
okay,
that.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
it's super cool, man. Do you guys have kids?
Two, yeah. I have a boy. He's about to turn 11 now in June. And then my daughter,
who just
turned 5 months.
It's great for kids. Yeah. It's super cool for kids, like beach camping specifically.
It's good. It's good to eliminate yourself also from the routine, you know? I think that's another good thing to teach kids.
It
eliminates yourself from – so, again, just a second, that point, California has an incredible diversity.
Yeah.
I mean, the plethora of things that you can get into is incredible, right? You can go to a city, San Francisco, and you can kind of go to the beach, San Diego, right? Like, there's a ton of different things on opposite sides of the spectrum. But the camping thing personally is something that I've never really gotten into because I can't get away, right? Like, I have to be here.
There's something you have to teach.
There's a tournament. There's always something going on. So, like, my schedule's. I mean, to get us here right now was
like a month.
A battle in and of itself.
Yeah, it was like a month back and forth. Yeah,
dude. So my schedule's cracking all the way through August right now.
Yeah.
So to get a week away, like. I'd like to, but
it's tough.
Very difficult. Yeah. Very difficult.
Well, let's talk about that because I think that's what most folks interest, you know, listening will be interested in, and I'm kind of interested in that too. You you're a coach, but you're also a competitor.
Correct.
And there's not a lot of folks doing both at the same time, yeah, right? It just seems
very
like sort of
efficiently,
mentally taxing, right? Like you gotta like look after your people, but also look after yourself. Right. You know, how do you balance that all together? Like, let's just talk about sort of like opening the academy, like when you knew it was gonna be a livelihood for you, your drive to compete. Let's just kind of go through it all. But let's start with just sort of like your schedule, right? Like did you ever watch Lost?
So amongst the things that I don't get to do is watch a lot of TV.
Yeah.
And I heard Lost was great. I just never got a chance to
get it. Yeah, Lost was great. But there's this scene, there's like this trope, this thing going on where like they had to like punch these codes into this computer to keep the world from blowing up. And they had to do it every so often, like every couple hours. Huh. And at first it doesn't seem so bad, but then you realize like, oh wait, the guy can't really get good sleep. Oh wait, the guy can't venture far away on the island because he has to like go back to the computer and type in this code.
Gotcha.
And so he winds up being like a slave to it, you know, because he can't leave. He can't go hunting.
He can't go far.
You can't do much. Not that it's that bad for you, but it sounds like there's something there that's similar, right? It's like you have to be there twice a day to teach your class.
Great.
Plus weekends.
Yeah.
And so it makes things like going to Tokyo very difficult.
So, I mean, logistically speaking, I have a good group of guys there that I can rely on
and yeah.
that I take off, you know, but I rarely take off. So for long periods, extended periods of time, I'll take off typically the weekends, right? So if I'm going to compete, it'll be like me taking off a Friday, Saturday, and then I'm back in Sacramento by Sunday, you know? An element of that too is that I have my son 1 week on and 1 week off with his mother.
Got it.
I never travel when...
He's when you have the
me.
Boy.
Yeah, when he's with me, I never travel. If I do a tournament, it's going to be local, you know, that type of thing. And I try to prioritize that time, especially now as I'm getting older. Like, that's the priority. I want to be with my kids.
Yeah.
But I digress. I have, like, when I went to Tokyo, I had a group of guys that were helping me out. Sean Cox, Marcus Bonas, these guys were helping me out exponentially at the gym. That helps a lot, you know, knowing that I can rely on them when I need to get that stuff done.
Okay.
But it makes it difficult because I teach, you know, 95% of my classes. I'm there all the time. I have some kids' classes. Sean's taking care of their kids' classes, but I do all the adult classes there. Man, and, you know, I think what it boils down to is passion, right? Like, I really love what I do, so that helps,
yeah.
right? I never had that comparative analysis where I said to myself, hey, look, you know, this sucks. But then I think to myself, oh, well, you could be behind a job. But behind a desk, you know.
I'm behind a desk. It's not luxurious.
Well, man, I mean, like this is pretty cool. This appears to be a passion, right?
And I enjoy this.
You know, I'm sure you can pursue this in avenues that might be profitable. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Dr. Rabago's paying a little bit for the sponsorship, and he's it's very modest. Eventually, I'd like to be able to quit my job and do just this. But
there you go. It starts with that.
Yeah,
that's the genesis of something greater.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But I'm a 9-to-5 guy right now.
I'm a 9-to-5.
I'm a 9-to-5 guy right now. I do.
So was I.
Yeah.
So was I. I mean, like, well into getting my black belt, I worked. I call myself the Renaissance man of the workforce. I worked anything that was necessary for me to pay the bill. Right? And that sucks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That sucks when you know you want something else and you have to kind of do this 9-to-5 just to comply with, you know, social norms because you have to produce a certain amount to be able to support materialism and amongst other things, right?
So let me talk to you about that a little bit. It's interesting you bring that up because that is like deep, deep conditioning in our society.
It is.
It's
yeah.
in there. So I kind of, you know, I like what I'm
By
doing
way, that,
sometimes.
That has permeated other societies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's everywhere.
I would consider that mentality a contaminant, right? That is infected other
yeah,
places
yeah.
as well. Right?
So I like what I do, but sometimes it can leave you high and dry. So I've been in the political game for like 8 years now.
Okay.
And so after my last assignment left me high and dry in terms of like my boss went to Congress, but it left his staff here in the state legislature looking for work.
Yeah.
My wife was like,
he moved up and left you guys behind.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have gone.
Do they typically take you guys with them, or how does that work?
I think it's a one-on-one conversation. Like, hey, do you want to go? Would you, you know, for me, it was like, I just got married. I just bought this house. I wouldn't have, you couldn't pay me to go, you know? Plus DC is not that luxurious for the people that work there.
Yeah.
You know, you make less money. The benefits aren't good.
I heard it's getting really ghetto too. I heard it's getting really
bad. It's really ghetto there. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have, for me, it wasn't even a conversation to have.
Good.
I wouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
But it did.
I like Sacramento.
Yeah, I like Sacramento. But it did kind of leave me like, oh my God, like, you know, 3 times in 3 years I've had to transition now. It's like, it's kind of feeling kind of high and dry, you know? Yeah, that's rough. So my wife was like, well, why don't you take a break? We have, you know, we have plenty of money. You don't need to go back to work right away. So I took some time off. I just didn't look for a little bit, you know? Not that I didn't look, but I was just kind of like.
What was the time frame that you were looking at? Like,
it was
a year off?
No, it was like August of last year through January of this year.
Okay.
So I took like 6 months off.
Five months,
5 months, something like that. And let me tell you, man, in those 5 months, I really got to reflect on what you just talked about, where it's people are like, the first thing they ask you is, what do you do?
It's this fucking rat race, man.
Yeah, it's a rat race.
It's a rat race. And you're running after a dollar just to feed the habit.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, people ask you,
What's the habit? It's flashing on friends and showing that you have something that you don't need, quite frankly, you know, like, dude. I rock jujitsu shirts everywhere because that's why I get a tan. Like, I don't go out to buy stuff like my jeans, much to my wife's dismay, or from like Costco.
Yeah. You know,
like that stuff, that pursuit of materialism is ridiculous.
It's the pursuit of materialism. And then also, like, when people ask you, what do you do? I find as I get into my 30s, they ask you what you do. They kind of want to, what they really want to know is like, where are you on the social ladder? Right, and does it make sense for me to be friends with you? Are you,
that's right.
Are you a ditch digger? I don't want to be friends. You do something luxurious and glamorous in my industry, and I want to like kind of piggyback off you. Right, yeah. Oh, let's be friends. You know, it's networking. Deep. Yeah, it's deep, deep social conditioning. I think people don't even realize when they're doing it. You know,
that's right. I get a kick out of seeing people of my age. I'm 37. I get a kick of people seeing people my age
doing that shit.
They ask me, "Hey, what do you do for a living?" I say, "I teach martial arts." Right.
Yeah.
And their demeanor changes, right? Because I consider myself well spoken.
They're like jealous. Yeah.
You know. The first thing that they tend to go to that I noticed was they ask me, hey, you know, like, well, what are you making? You know, like, how,
you know. You should ask them, what are they making? What are you making?
Like, left or right? that's what it comes down to, right? Yeah. They're sizing you up. They're sizing you up. They're seeing, you know, are you making more than them? Are they making more than you, right? And how they can get on board if they are, you know? And, you know, like, I don't divulge any of my stuff, right?
Yeah,
I handle the admin of my business, right? So I know where I stand amongst people. Huh. And for them to behave in that sort of fashion with me is, once I'm merited,
it's kind of gross, right? Yeah.
And it's gross. It's gross. Like people, they look at you and they have these conversations with you just to be able to feel better about themselves.
Right? Yeah, what are you making? I'm making black belts, bitch. Shut up.
Yeah.
I'm making black belts, I'm making memories.
I'm conquering Tokyo.
Yeah. It's totally crazy. It's like, you know, like you get to really... I got to really reflect on what I wanted out of life, you know, in these 5 months. I am actually enjoying what I'm doing right now. I do kind of like political consulting and communications work. I don't know if you see those billboards like with the fist up, it says vote now.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of our clients. So the work is rewarding, but nonetheless, you're still going to a job. You're still putting your ass down at a desk. The one compromise I was able to get.
I love jiu-jitsu, but I have to do the admin. I can't stand that stuff. I can't stand it at all. But you know what? I do it. I do it because it feeds the passion.
So what kind of admin work is there associated with?
Everything.
Really?
That means books. That means contracts. That means – so I handle the input of all of our students and the maintenance of their accounts and things like that.
Like in your little software system?
Yeah. I have a software system called MindBody. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
But, no.
I specifically use that one because of its app integration. It allows for me to work on
like remotely?
Yeah, remotely from any place. Like I was in Japan. I was doing contract work and stuff.
So, oh, cool.
Yeah, and that's a blessing and a curse. I had to learn also to moderate that, so I'm not on the phone all the damn time.
You know, yeah,
I have to do
it,
you know, incrementally, so that way I'm not suffering in other aspects of my life.
You know what I did recently was I got a flip phone, and I just turned my iPhone in for like 2 weeks, and I was just on the flip phone. I could feel my brain chemistry changing.
Yeah.
It's like quitting drinking or quitting coffee. It's like quitting some sort of a drug.
Yep, it is, yeah.
I mean, they have vision scientists figure out how to make it like as enchanting as possible, you know, all the swirly shit on the screen, icons kind of dancing at you.
Speaking of which, Tokyo was very much like this, right? It's almost overwhelming. You walk in the streets and there's a ton of there's these screens everywhere and all these different things. And I would assume it's of the same vein, right? They're trying to get you as enchanted with what's going on there as possible.
Yeah.
But to the people there, it's like normal. They're walking around. It's like normal. This is crazy, right? Like, imagine Vegas, but instead of lights, there's a bunch of TVs everywhere.
Yeah. My uncle came to visit me about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And he was like, he was annoyed with me because I was checking my phone while we were catching up. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, people are checking their phone compulsively. He's a doctor. I mean, he knows what he's talking about. He was a emergency room surgeon in Mexico City. So he's seen it all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's safe to say he's probably seen it all.
He's seen it all, man. Yeah. But he said to me, you know, like people are checking it. They're checking their phone compulsively. He's like, where do you think the zombies come from?
Yeah.
He's like, it's this idea of you just can't get enough. You're just looking at it compulsively. And, you know? Yeah. And he says it's really driven by consumerism.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
You know? So you have to, just in terms of like getting a school together, right? You have to identify a group of students that'd be willing to go with you. And then you open up the school or you like open the doors and say, hey, I'm open for business and people trickle in. How does that work?
So I used to teach for my instructor back in the days at a couple different affiliates.
Okay.
They were in Grass Valley and Woodland respectively. And then I consolidated my efforts because that's just too much of a drive.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Too much of a drive. And I consolidated my efforts here in South Sac. And then in doing so, I kind of built my nucleus, what's now the hardcore group of guys, right? And then we moved into we had a couple different iterations of that. We moved to a couple different places, and now we've ended up right here off of 65th, right around the corner actually from where we're at right now. And tail end of Broadway and 65th, and we've been there for 3 years.
So the Fong building.
The Fong and Fong.
Fong and Fong.
Fong and Princess Center, yeah. Dude, the lady has been fantastic with me, Karen, the owner. She's very attentive, always, you know, we have great channels of dialogue. So I like being in that environment, you know.
Okay.
It's close to Sac State, you know, very close to our demographics.
You had some students in there?
Yeah. So, you know, for the most part, people will also look out for good gyms of jiu-jitsu. One of the things I noticed when we were doing the marketing aspect of it is that having a storefront facility is not necessary. You don't need to pay the extra buck per square footage because...
It's quite a bit extra, isn't it?
It is exponentially. It could be like 33% or more, a third more. And you don't need that, dude. You don't need it because 95% of our guys, of our new students, were coming in by way of
they searched for it.
Searches, Google, that type of stuff. That's another thing that changed over time, right? So, look, we just got a spot in the back of the Fong and Fong printing center, and people find us all the time.
Yeah.
No problems there. So.
You know, it's interesting because I talked to Manny, and Manny with Half Gracie's gym. And he's like, well, no, I mean, I do pay a little extra for the storefront, but I'm right by a McDonald's. And you can't imagine how many people I get that come in because they're...
So that's going to help.
Because they're eating a cheeseburger and they feel like a piece of shit. So they want to come in and, you know...
Probably happens a lot.
And before you know it, before you know it, they're paying dues.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it's one of those things where it's like...
So in that case, it probably helps, right?
We were in if you're area, right by a McDonald's, yeah.
Well, we were right by an area that was probably not a very good area. Like, I had this idealistic view. It's kind of like you're leaving law school for the first time and you have this view that you're going to change law in the world. And 10 years later, you realize
it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So I moved at a place, Sky Parkway and 65th, where I would say, you know, kind of what we were talking about before, the community almost doesn't want to help themselves. They're happy in the rut. They love being in the ghetto, and that's they kind of embrace that. And there's no ask. I wouldn't say no because that's generalizing too much. But
The majority it is how it is, and that's how it's going to be.
They don't want to progress. They don't want to get
Is that down by like where the 24 hour is?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
Where the whole, I think the good guy shooting happened there.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
What was it, 15 years back or plus or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy. That was crazy. So, not a good area, man. And so, I can imagine in his case, moving closer to a place that's, you know, that's transited, that has, makes a lot more, you know, traffic, foot traffic and otherwise. It's got to be a benefit to the business, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So, but for you, it's okay to be searched for and people are like looking for you.
Yeah.
So you got your group of students, you're kind of like wandering around till you finally find the spot that you've settled in now. Mm-hmm. And now it's kind of it's going, right? Like you kind of hit like this cruise control where it's like, all right, I've got my group of students and I'm settled in the spot. How do you sort of like keep growing? How do you sort of keep that momentum going and keep it from just like, oh, I'm just showing up at this thing?
So I wouldn't utilize the terminology cruise control because that would imply complacency.
Okay.
And no offense.
Sure.
My grind is never a complacent one. I'm always working.
Again, okay.
I'm 37 for the most part. People at my age have pretty much retired from that type of work.
That grind right? mentality. That grind, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I have a marketing guy that helps me, Ruben Avila. He's a guy that I talk to, and I have an open channel dialogue at geomarketing. How do I get max exposure within a particular radius, and what do we need to do to make these type of things happen? So this is an ongoing conversation.
Okay.
Investing money into marketing, into that type of stuff, realizing the potential of the social media tools, right?
Yeah.
Because I come from a time where, look, I didn't have a phone until I was 25, right? And so now imagine in 10 years, I've had to really, you know, come to terms with how, you know, with how important it is.
Yeah.
And at least from my perspective personally, what I can do is continue to be a character within that play. I go to tournaments, I compete.
And do you think that helps?
Man, you know,
like, why do you compete? To increase your own name value? You compete because you love it. You compete because it's fun.
If it was because of name recognition, I would have stopped a long time
ago. Okay.
I do because I love it. Like, intrinsically, I am, I gravitate exponentially to that type of conflict. The one-on-one conflict, right? Like, it's a fascinating thing to me.
Okay.
And more because of how it changes me personally, right? Like, how I have to work hard and I have to transcend a lot of my own thresholds to be able to continually do this, right? Mm-hmm. That's the reason why I like it. But I can't deny that there is a pool that helps, you know, helps marketing and helps everything else.
When you win a big tournament.
When you win a big tournament. And
of course.
Your guys are winning tournaments and, you know, like when you're turning heads, right, that definitely gets a lot of attention. And in a increasingly competitive sport like jiu-jitsu, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think a lot of people are moving more towards the competitive aspect of it, less towards the self-defense aspect of it. How would I put this? I'm sorry. That's a whole other argument in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, if you want to address that.
Yeah. You know, by the way, I'm not very fond of the argument.
I'm not super fond of it either.
I think that it's just groups of people that refuse to evolve at the times that are trying to alienate another group and maintain relevance.
Okay.
Is what it is. Because quite frankly, if you're doing sport jiu-jitsu, a good blue belt at my school is going to know takedowns. They're going to know their guards. They're going to know their passing. A good blue belt at my school is going to know pretty much, they're going to have good awareness, right? And that in and of itself is a very good base for
self-defense.
Yeah. And anybody that tells you different is trying to blow smoke up your ass.
Yeah. Okay. Well, So let's take that and put it aside. And maybe let's think about jiu-jitsu as a product.
Okay.
Like, what do you want to watch on TV? How do we get casual people to engage in this thing? I'll sit at home and watch like the EBIs, you know, and you got like Keenan Cornelius like inverted and kind of scooting towards somebody. Mm-hmm. And my wife is like, you know, I watch the UFC stuff with you. I get it. But this other stuff, you know, you got people stalled out, grabbing the gis.
Yeah.
Both, you know, 50, you know, in stuck in 50-50 double guard pulls, and she's like, you know,
same thing can be said about takedowns, by the way.
Yeah absolutely. I mean, no, like, so I mean,
it's not alienating.
Yeah, no, I mean, Olympic wrestling has its own absurdities for correct, sure, yeah, right, yeah. I think that like what happens is you have the,
and it could happen, by the way, in MMA too. If, I mean,
oh yeah, lay in prey is yeah, yeah,
boring fighters that don't want to do anything, right?
So I think you have like the spirit of the art lives somewhere outside the rules. Like the rules are just kind of like what we come up with to decide a winner, mm-hmm, when two people are really evenly matched. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of like these criteria that we overlay on top of the actual thing.
Yeah.
And the actual thing is just like, is like the art itself, right?
I agree, yeah.
But as far as, you know, I think as a product, jiu-jitsu, and you're right, it's everywhere. I mean,
That's the participant, by the way. That bends those rules.
Yeah.
It that transcends, like we were talking, like you just said right now, it transcends the essence of the art and what makes it appealing to the masses, right? Quite frankly,
yeah.
And what it ends up being is this game where they're skirting the lines. They're skirting a very fine line of what's legal and what's not, to be able to inch out victories, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that is inherently a big part of most sports, I would say, most sports have these stallers. They have these people that play the rules.
Yeah, I think it's a. I think it's a problem for me specifically with jiu-jitsu. I think advantages are a problem, and I think that. And yeah, you know, you're free to disagree with me, of course. But in fact, you should, because you have more competition experience than me. And I also don't like the complexity of the rules. Wrestling is very simple. I'd like to see something like wrestling. In wrestling, if you're the guy on bottom, and if somehow you wind up on top, it doesn't matter if you use your legs for the sweep. It doesn't matter what happened. If you're on bottom and you wind up on top, that's a reversal. That's 2 points. Okay. With jiu-jitsu, it's kind of like, well, you have to use your legs for the sweep. And if the guy on bottom, you know, gets up, but then he's kind of taken back down again, it's not really a takedown because he was on bottom to begin with. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like complexity to those rules that I think makes it, one, hard to follow for the casual fan, and then two, easy to kind of game, like you were talking about, where it's like, I would like to see something more like rewarding position, where it's like, hey, you're on bottom, now you're on top. That's a point, regardless of what happened. You know what I mean? I don't
think that doesn't address the complexity behind the positions. Remember that wrestling, I had a similar perspective as yours before I started reffing.
Okay.
Once I started reffing and I really dove into, like, I knew the rules before, but when I started reffing, you really have to employ them. So it becomes your understanding of it is,
you're like a little judge almost,
exponentially higher, right? And with that comes also, I think, an appreciation as to why they were developed, right? Wrestling has very simple positions. Judo has simpler positions, right? Judo has its own set of garbage rules too.
It does, yeah. No grabbing. Wrestling has its own set of garbage rules. They all do. Yeah.
All of them do. Yeah. But jiu-jitsu has, there are many more positions within that need to be defined, and they need to be clarified. And when you're clarifying those positions and you transcend those to move into other positions, it becomes a very murky water.
Okay.
And it forces in like the rule that you're utilizing right now, which is you know, takedowns when knee on the floor, if there's a switch of positions, for instance, somebody's mounted on you,
yeah,
and you roll them over with a barrel roll. That, you know, that back in the days when I first started jiu-jitsu was 2 points.
Yeah.
Not anymore, because there was never technically a guard. You see what I'm saying? So that necessitates an identification of what a guard is, right? So the understanding of all these complex positions is growing. And yes, does it create rules that I don't agree with? Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Just because I ref doesn't mean I agree with
all. Well, okay, so let's go back to the guard thing, right? There's never technically a guard, but is not winding up on top worthy of being rewarded?
Why?
Because you're going to smash the person, because you're going to hold them down, and your homies are going to stop. You're going to, I mean, it's for sure.
It's a preconceived notion.
But I think in
MMA, okay, so what's yours is a preconceived notion based off of a perspective maybe provided to you by MMA or something else, right? So you're saying that this is a dominant position. The top is a dominant position. It should be rewarded because it's the top.
Right? In all grappling arts, the top is considered a dominant position.
So
I submit
to you the study of Damian Maia and guys that utilize the bottom as a phenomenal tool at getting up and exploiting people in their weak areas, which in MMA, for the most part, happens to be on the bottom.
Right.
So I submit to you guys like Damian Maia, Morelli Bustamante, who in their MMA careers have shown that the bottom can be a very useful tool.
No, for sure.
When employed properly.
Yeah. So there's the bottom. There's the bottom in MMA, which can totally be useful in MMA. I also think just in the idea that you're okay on bottom also assumes a fair fight in the streets. Like if I was in a self-defense situation in the streets and I wouldn't want to be on bottom just for fear of being held down and being like stomped out by the homies.
Okay. Yeah.
That, I mean, that's the only thing. It's like, I think that's why a lot of the other grappling arts have an appreciation for being on top for its own sake, because when you're on top, you can, you can just disengage and walk away.
By the way, I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know.
The points awarded to a pass are 3. That's a lot, right? You mount off of that, that's 4.
No.
Does that make sense? You sweep, you get 2.
Yeah.
So very clearly within the rules, they are prioritizing top positions.
Oh, interesting. Correct. Never thought of it like that. That makes sense, yeah. You're getting more potential points if you're on top and you work on top.
Yeah. By the way,
got it.
Let me create a scenario for you. A guy pulls guard, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't sweep, which would only be 2. But the other guy on top passes, that's 3. He gets knee on the stomach, another 2, 5. Then he mounts, he gets 4, right? That's 9 points. That's a 9-point deficit where the other person on the bottom only has
2 potential points.
A 2, maybe a 6, because he might sweep to a back, right?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So they're right there. You'll see on a macro level that the point scoring opportunities on top are much higher than the bottom, right?
Interesting, interesting. Yeah,
because so they are prioritizing
you get,
that.
Because yeah, because you get points for passing the guard, and you don't get points for retaining the guard.
You don't, not at all. You don't get a damn thing. Not a damn thing.
That's interesting.
And for near passes, you get advantages. So yeah. this might change your idea of advantages, because I think that if you get a near pass, I don't know if I agree with that, the advantage to half guard specifically. This is getting a little technical, but for those that are following us, if you get to a half guard position, the person on the bottom is just locking the half guard and you control their head. That's an advantage.
Especially like a three-quarter guard, like kind of you get the knee out and kind of like
squeeze the head. So I don't necessarily agree with that one personally, right?
That's a really easy position to get. And I think that the guy on bottom isn't necessarily done fighting, because a lot of times when you're in that lockdown position, the guy on bottom can kind of sweep underneath for a real deep half. Yeah. The guy on bottom, I think, has a lot of fight left still.
I think so too, right? Especially if they have a good half guard game. So, I think that you should get advantages for near passes, which for me would merit an advantage, and that should be the reason why advantages exist, is to determine when somebody nearly gets a pass or nearly gets the back position, because that should be considered an advantage over the other, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Say there is no point scoring position, you need to be able to put on the scoreboard, this guy was showing initiative, the prerogative was that he was going to, take
it's
the
like
back
judgment pass. Criteria or something.
Judgment criteria. Yeah. And this, again, this piggybacks off what we were saying before. We need to have a criteria to be able to define the terms of engagement. We need to have it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's a crapshoot. And you have the UFC from back in the SEG days and back in Horry and Gracie days is what you're going
to
have.
Yeah. So I kind of like Fight to Win. They just have the guys with the flags.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like – I kind of like that. I think it's kind of pure, because it's – a lot of times, I don't know. This guy took the other guy down, but when he did, he landed in a triangle and barely got out.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, how do you score all that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This guy.
So I've seen people completely dominant, positionally speaking. Yeah, the other guy gets
jiu-jitsu.
A submission attempt.
Yeah,
and that will get him the nod.
Yeah.
So, by the way, that doesn't come without its own set of problems. The Fight to Win Pro, I think, is, and this is the reason why I support them, is I think that that's one of the better. That's one of the better ways of critiquing a match.
I think people watch it and be like, I think we all know who won that fight. I think we all know who won
for
that.
For the most part.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like Kid Dale and Jake Shields. I don't know if you saw their fight.
No, I didn't.
In Oakland.
I'll check it out.
That was polemic. People were left unsatisfied.
Okay.
That, right? You had...
Who wound up getting the nod? Shields?
Shields did, yeah.
He has a way of he has a way of getting his hand raised.
Arguably, Kit Dale took it.
Really?
Right?
Okay.
A lot of people say that Kit Dale had a better attempt at the end at submissions, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to tell you who I won, because I don't want to alienate either group, right? I'm like, that we'll save that for off the mic. I'm joking.
Sure.
But you see what I'm saying? Like, it's not without its own set of problems.
Yeah.
Right? What if one person goes for a submission attempt and the other person goes for a submission attempt?
Do you think the judges should be able to say, all right, guys, you guys fought for 10 good minutes. I think we can all agree it's kind of close right now. I need you guys to go for 5 more.
So look,
you think that should be allowed
in the Fight to Win scenario? Why not?
Yeah.
Seth completely has a control. Seth Daniels, the head of Fight to Win right there. He's an absolute animal. He competes in those own events too, right?
What a savage.
So savage. So he has the capacity to do so, right?
Yeah.
I know they run a tight ship, and they run on
time.
Crazy time,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they do a really good job with that.
But say something polemic was to happen, maybe in the last two, co-main and main events.
Yeah,
right. Say something was to happen there, and people are left unsatisfied. Maybe he's left unsatisfied with the result. Fuck it, put him another.
He should be sitting up there like a king.
2 minutes,
like with a throne, with like a throne and a
crown and a, what do you call these, baston, with a
like a cane.
With a skull on it,
like Shaolin in the old Mortal Kombat. So you should be sitting up there, be like, all right, I need you fuckers to go
with
5 more.
Yeah, so it's gonna have a mask on. He already has a chain and stuff, right? He gets it down.
Seth, there's some feedback for you. We need you to sit up there on a throne and tell people they need to go for 5 more minutes.
Yeah, man. Look, there's something like that. I'm down for, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I'm down for. If they didn't do what was necessary within regulation time to get it done.
Yeah.
Or maybe they were, and it was just so close and contested that we need another couple minutes to be able to decipher who the clear winner was.
Should be okay, right? Especially at the high level stuff. If you got two blue belts duking it out and they're both tired, okay, I get it. You guys, good. We'll catch you guys next year. Keep working.
Mm-hmm.
But at the highest levels, people paid their $30 a head.
And so in the IBJJF, they couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Too many rounds, too many matches that'll push event time way beyond
what's
acceptable.
Yeah.
Well, if you can't do it in the smaller opens for fear of it going way over time, then you can't do it at the big ones. For sure. Like Worlds or Masters Worlds or something like that. That's crazy.
Yeah, let's go back to that in 1 second because I want to go back again to this idea that we had about like, hey, we kind of all know who won the fight and this criteria for winning the fight. I was watching Pan Ams from Flow Grappling. Best $130 I ever spent, you know. Actually, I saw this guy, another Mexican named Jabron. He's from Gracie Barra, I think, Mexico City.
And he Jabron?
Jabron in English, Gibran in Espanol.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, and then it's a Lebanese name. They want to say Jabron. Okay. Gibran, you know.
Okay.
And then white people or like Americans see the G and they want to say Gibran. And there's no real.
I came in and said Gibran.
Yeah, Gibran. Yeah, I appreciate that.
My bad.
I knew you were an OG when I heard you say that because that's how Mexicans would say. And you saw the sugar skulls and called me Gibran, which is right. So there's another Gibran. In a black belt, in a match, and he was getting positionally dominated. You know, he lost the match by maybe like 4 points. Like, I think he got swept twice or something like that. You know, at the end of the match, at the last like minute of the match, he grabs an ankle like a toe hold.
Okay.
And pretty much breaks his opponent's foot.
Okay.
You know, but the opponent just kind of
shakes it off.
And you know, time gets called and they both get up and the opponent has his arm raised, right? But then you watch him, he limps off the mat. He can't put any, like his coach had to come on the mat and he had to like kind of limp. Yeah, he had to limp off. Yeah, and you know what they're going to do is they're going to bandage that. They're going to bandage that ankle and he's going to go on and fight again. He's going to protect that ankle for the rest of the tournament. You mean to tell me the guy who limped off the mat is the one that won? I don't think so. You know,
But then you're not falling within the criteria.
You're not falling within the criteria. No, that's why I like the fight to win.
We created the rules.
Yeah.
Right. We created the rules. And we have to fall within the criteria. So within the rule set, he won.
Within the rule set, he won.
Yeah.
But one guy's leaving with a broken ankle and one guy isn't.
Okay. I've seen many cases in MMA where the person that's leaving, the person that won the match is completely destroyed.
Yeah,
like,
yeah
cuts
yeah.
all over the place. Yeah. Broken nose.
Yeah, no, destroyed. I'm not defending MMA. Like,
no. I'm trying to create parallels here.
Sure, so maybe
we can change the perspective.
Sure, right?
So within MMA, you see a guy completely destroyed, but he took the win.
Maybe
off a knockout or something like that. But the other guy was tooling him the rest of the fight.
Yeah, right?
And has a perfect
face
roster.
Yeah,
he's a perfect roster. So you and I look at each other and say, you know, damn, it looks like one guy won the fight. But it wasn't necessarily that case.
Yeah,
you know, we are all subject to the rules.
So how would you? I get that. I get that. How would you feel about a rule where it's like, and this is one of the things that
So by the way, from a personal perspective, I didn't mean to interrupt, but from the personal perspective, this is why I support Fight to Win Pro, because I try to dominate positionally speaking, and I try to attack submissions. Right. That's the reason why I support them. I support them because I like the idea that if you hunt and you go after your opponent, you're going to get rewarded for that, right?
Yeah.
And that might be in the form of a nod, by the refs.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel this. I kind of feel the same way. Like, and this is one of the, I think this is one of the things too. When people talk about the degrading of the self defense value of jiu-jitsu in the sport jiu-jitsu, mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I think about is, you know, if you get an armbar on the street, you're probably going to subdue the individual, right?
Okay.
But if you get an arm bar like in a black belt IBJJF semifinal, you're going to break that arm and they're going to keep going.
Okay.
And where it's like, that's kind of not real. I mean, that's kind of not realistic. Like, for most self-defense perspectives, people will stop at the arm bar. But at the highest levels of grappling, it's like, well, the people are just going to let you break their arm and you got to keep kind of grappling through it, where it's you know, as a theoretical practice, it kind of makes sense. And I'm glad that those exchanges are happening because I like to watch that shit, you know what I mean? But it's kind of like, okay, well, that's, we definitely know that scenario wouldn't happen on the street. Like the people were just
kind of, possible, though. You know? What if you have a guy that's, I don't know, drunk
or on PCP,
PCP or something like that, and he's not respecting his own thresholds, his physical thresholds.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, I mean, if you ask me, there's no better conditioning for a person in a real life scenario than to constantly train against a person who is educated in their craft, right?
Yeah.
Like if you are training against black belts every day, it's safe to assume that.
Oh no, for sure. Yeah, no, for sure. Street, those guys can defend themselves for sure. I totally agree with that. Yeah. Right?
So, and it comes back to, again, what we were talking about at the very beginning. These people on this side of the fence are saying that this is very bad. Sport jiu-jitsu is very bad. This is not pure. This is not pure jiu-jitsu.
Yeah,
it is not this elitist group of jiu-jitsu, right? And they're doing that to maintain relevance because, quite frankly, they fall. Because
they can't compete in the sport jiu-jitsu.
No, you can. They can. Okay. Oh, yeah, they can. Go to Master 4, 5, whatever corresponds to you. Go out there and compete and do it. And if you can't physically for one reason or another, that doesn't mean that you stop learning, that you don't bring the information to the table, right? Yeah. You know, how dare they come from an environment where jiu-jitsu itself, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it was an evolution of what came prior.
Yeah.
Right? Was it not at its fundamental level an evolution of what came prior? It was. Judo, there's a funny story in judo that in Japan, the governing body for a while was the stand-up school, right? They loved the stand-up. And they stand up and they did these phenomenal things. Well, there was a school that broke off from that and worked a lot more than it was, the groundwork.
Yeah.
And they started beating them in tournaments, schooling them in tournaments.
Yeah.
And so the rules changed as a result. They stopped with the groundwork and they limited it.
So you get 15 seconds or something like that. 25 seconds
at that time. I think it was before, it was less. They did that to do what? It was a political move.
Yeah.
That's some bullshit political moves. Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. There's a very famous story that's not publicized much, but there's a group of people. They have like challenge matches between the Gracies and a number of other people. And Oswaldo Fada, right, and a bunch of his lineage went out there and they footlocked the hell out of a bunch of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu guys.
Okay.
Helio Gracie said famously, it takes a Fada to show that Jiu-Jitsu is not just of the Gracies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this was an example of evolution. They were falling behind because they weren't incorporating the footlocks. Those other guys in Japan and for judo were not staying up with the times because they weren't incorporating the groundwork. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Jiu-jitsu now they're really far. Now they're really far behind those guys, by the way, because now they weren't incorporating the groundwork. They're not incorporating the footlocks either.
Yeah. So,
you know, like they're really far behind.
There's a lot of really good stuff going on with the legs that they're just missing, man, because they don't want. So again, you don't have to employ it in your own game, but you have to study it and you have to be aware of it. And you have to learn how to defend it at least, and you have to learn how to teach it because you might have students that gravitate to that stuff, and it's important to be able to make your jiu-jitsu accessible, you know, universally speaking, to all the guys.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
So it is an evolution. It's always been. For you to stop here now and say, no, we stop evolving because this is the pure jiu-jitsu, come on, bro, that's bullshit.
This is where I liked it.
That's bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
In my opinion.
How would you feel about a rule, like if you are visibly injured, if you didn't tap but you were visibly injured, if you didn't tap but you need medical help, you lose?
There is.
Is there?
There is.
Because I saw this guy win this match because he was limping off.
Judges intervene if there's a throw up, for instance.
Yeah.
This is another example of that, right? If the fighter can no longer intelligently defend themselves,
right?
The ref is made to come in. But I'm sorry, as a black belt, what they tell us very clearly in the rules seminars is that if they're a black belt and they let it break, that's up to them.
Yeah.
That's up to them.
But I think once you get you don't think that once you get your shit broken, you lost the match? You don't think that's a...
Nope, not at all.
Man, okay.
How many times have you walked into a tournament or to a training session hurt?
All the time. Yeah.
Everybody that's listening to this podcast can resonate with this.
Yeah.
Each and every one of us has walked in with a faded finger, faded back, a faded knee. Something was faded. Yet we persist and we overcome.
Okay. Right?
So that's an example of having to transcend a momentary obstacle.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Okay.
You have Jacare that fought against Haji Gracie, it was 2004, got his arm broken. But he kept winning that match. He was winning the match already. He had taken Haji Gracie's backs, and everybody, Haji Gracie won the match because he broke his arm.
Dude, yeah, I think so. Like
he got out of the arm bar.
I think so.
He got out of the arm bar. And again, it's safe to argue with that. I mean, I'm providing a perspective.
Yeah, I think we both are. I think this is fun.
My perspective is, hey, look, if they fight and they grin and bear, they bite their tongue and they swallow the blood and they push through it, it's, man, more power to them.
Yeah.
Can't tell you how many times I've gone out there, faded, faded. People don't see it.
On your knees, just everything, whatever.
Faded, faded, right? One time in Chicago, I got this guy caught me in a footlock. I went up a couple weight divisions because nobody was in lightweight, nobody was in middleweight, so I went up to medium heavy. The very first minute, he sat back on my foot and he went to war on my foot, right? And I heard my foot popping left and right, and I had to maintain pretenses, right? But that was the first match. I went on to win division in absolute, no gi in Chicago. That wouldn't have happened if some ref, ref determined that because of a couple of pops, I was no longer able to continue.
I get that. So you don't want that opportunity taken from you. No, as a black belt, you feel like, oh, I'm here to fight.
Yeah. And I look back on that as an experience. You know, like if I limp today, sometimes it's because of that damn footlock. But
it still got you to this day.
Yeah. And so arguably, you know, that person won
the war,
but I won
the battle. He took it out of you, yeah. I mean, that is, you know, it's totally subjective too. It's totally subjective. You were talking earlier, and I think this is interesting, and this is some feedback for the grappling world in general about like the tournament scene. And kind of like you can't do that, hey, 5 more minutes in the jiu-jitsu tournaments because it would just all go over time, you know?
Yep.
One thing that I think Jits does really well is that they can tell you typically pretty accurately when the person that you're watching is going to fight.
Yeah.
Wrestling
tournaments. It wasn't always like that.
No, yeah. Wrestling tournaments don't do that. I was coaching at Bradshaw Christian on Bradshaw.
Yeah.
In Calvine. It's my wife's son's wrestling, school. So I just went in there to try and bond with him a little bit. So, and also I wrestled in high school and college, so I missed it a little bit, you know. But we would go to these wrestling tournaments. And it's just like, dang, man. Like, so the way they do is they do like...
It's an all-day affair.
It's an all-day affair. And
you might be there till like midnight. I've seen...
You might be there for 2 days.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I remember one time we were there on a Saturday night. And we were with the kid as he was cutting weight on Thursday night. Friday all day. You know? And then Saturday night. And it's like, shit. Like, we're here. It's Friday, Saturday night. Wrapping this up. We really got started Thursday night.
Yeah.
Ugh. Who would want... You know, who wants to do it? Yeah. You know, and what they do is they like run all the brackets concurrently. So they do the first round of lightweight, then the first round of welterweight, then the first round of middleweight. You know what I mean? What I really like about jiu-jitsu is they take the whole bracket and they're like, all right, all you fuckers, come here. We're going to settle this right now.
Right now.
Mm-hmm. You guys got 3 mats. You know, you need to catch your breath after. Okay. You catch your breath for a little bit. You get 5 minutes, then you're going.
Yeah.
Love that. It works so much better.
I do too. Yeah.
And
I understand that some of the black belts, they have divisions like up to quarters on Saturday and then like semifinals and finals on Monday. I don't like that. I like to conquer the mountain. If you fight 5 times in 1 day, that's conquering the mountain.
Yeah.
If you take 2 1 day, then 2 the next day, you technically did 2 different tournaments.
Right? Yeah.
You went home, slept, ate, you come back 10 pounds heavier, right? No.
Yeah.
Five fights in one day. That's the
mountain,
right? Yeah. I love that. Again, personally speaking.
And I mean, I think it also keeps it more pure because then you get a sense of like who's the better conditioned athlete.
Yeah.
You know, and it's more compelling too, right? Like if you can, maybe one guy had like a 10-minute war and the other guy tapped his boy out in like 3 minutes. And so the guy with the 10-minute war comes in like really tired, but he finds a way to win the match anyways, you know, like that's prestige as a product. That's really good to watch.
That's prestige for me. That is prestige. Overcoming the mountain and all of its adversities, right? Like, I mean, you can have a number of different obstacles. They can be either fast rounds or short rounds, right?
Yeah.
And the long round that is really hard and contentious, right? You can overcome those things, man. You can leave that day saying, man, you know what? I left that battlefield. You didn't leave unscathed.
Yeah.
But you left with a gold medal. There's a lot to be said for something like that.
Absolutely.
It's a huge feeling of accomplishment.
Yeah. How are you doing on time? You doing all right?
We got to boogie soon. I got to boogie soon, like within the next 10. If
that's okay. Yeah. No, that's fine.
Sorry, man.
All good. I know you got a class to teach. So.
Yeah.
Just quickly, let me ask you, I'm interested in this. How did you get started? Was it like a Bruce Lee, like I want to be the baddest guy on, you know, so I had Dustin Nakbari and Mansur, and they're like, man, for me, it was Bruce Lee. And so for me, it was too, actually. I got started with Shotokan.
Yeah, so like, I mean, I'm from an older age, right?
Okay.
I'm 1980.
Okay.
So in my, like when I was born, I was coming up, you know, I saw a ton of guys on TV, right? I saw
Chuck Norris and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
There was like the 80s guys that were like Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Van Damme, and this Aikido guy, right? The fat guy.
Steven Seagal.
So that was like the 80s, 90s, right?
Yeah.
But the ones I saw when I was a little kid were like the 70s and 60s, right? So it was a lot of like the old school Jackie Chans And Jackie Chan was crazy. Like, I loved
watching people Jackie sleep Chan. On Jackie Chan, man. That guy's a motherfucker.
He had great movies, right? Yeah. Great movies, too. Like, plus the comedic value as a kid really went far in determining, like, my playfulness, right? Like playfulness with other people, how I engaged with other people. Like, I loved how he engaged with everybody, right?
Yeah. It was phenomenal.
So I watched him. Obviously, Bruce Lee was a huge fountain of inspiration, right?
Yeah.
Chuck Norris too. Chuck Norris was a huge badass. So I saw all these 70s movies when I was a kid, and then obviously with the popularity of the action movie star in the 80s, that, you know, that stuff really took off, you know. And my first experience with it was you know, the UFC had a really hard time sanctioning events, getting events run within the United States.
Yeah.
So they took it to Puerto Rico.
UFC
8 was in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And so, man, there was a bunch of guys staying at this hotel I was working at, right? And I saw a bunch of them, you know, and they were doing like these movie cuts outside. I was like, what the hell's going on? They're like, oh yeah, there's something going on this weekend at
Bayamon. It's like karate versus kung fu something. Yeah.
They were, people were ignorant. So they said it was like it's like a boxing, but no gloves type of stuff. I was like, what the hell is this? Right. Cause I boxed as a kid. So I went over there and, man, it was crazy. Changed everything about my life. You know, I saw a Shamrock roll underneath and grab Kinemo in a leg lock.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember being like blown away. What the hell just
that
happened?
I want to learn to do that. No
freaking clue, right?
Yeah.
I look back on it years afterwards, and I obviously now I know what it was, but at the time I was just like, wow, what was that? What did I just see, right? Imagine seeing all the martial arts and striking martial arts and everything, and then you've seen a real environment like that, and it ending almost abruptly was a real powerful thing for me. It kind of hit a particular note with me. So then I came to the States, and that was like in April of 99, and then July.
What brought you to the States?
I had a cousin that was working at off West El Camino, Providian Financial. I don't know if you remember, they had a bank over there
for a while,
before they went belly up.
Okay.
And he said, man, you could be in the Spanish-speaking department, you know, making double what I was making at the casino. Just not that much in Puerto Rico. I was making like $6 an hour.
Yeah.
And I was going to be making $12 an hour, which at that time for me, man, I was moving up.
Yeah.
And I was going to make some money and then go back. And I never went.
Puerto Rico.
No, I never went back to live there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was staying there with my grandmother at the time, and I never went back.
She's not still expecting you, are you? Is she? I'm just kidding.
No, she's since passed.
Oh,
she's sorry, man.
Passed.
No. She's since passed. But she was always very, very happy in seeing the development within jiu-jitsu. She knew that I loved that type of stuff. So it didn't rub all my family members the right way, right?
Right. Yeah,
I'll bet. It's a very hard thing getting into martial arts when everybody's expecting for you to get into something else, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to my insurer about that. I was like, you know, because he's like a very established Indian family. And they're like, oh, you know, maybe you should be a doctor. Maybe you should be a lawyer. Like,
preconceived notions. Yeah. Well, these are preconceived notions of behaviors that are acceptable in our society.
It's that conditioning we're talking about.
That conditioning, yeah.
Mom struggled with it, or your parents struggled? Family generally?
Both of my parents struggled with it, you know. I think my mom came to accept it, but after already seeing that I got a gym and I started building from it, right?
Like, she's like, oh, now it's okay.
Yeah, you know, in hindsight, it's 2020, right? That's the joke, right? Is that everybody looks back and they could say, oh, well, you know, I was right to be cautious, or I was right to, and arguably so, that they were justified, you know? As a parent, you always want to express concern when your child is taking these
like drastic a different paths, or a new path,
right? But there comes a point where, you know, you have to support them too as well in making their decisions. And I tell my son, look, I don't care what you do. You could be a painter, you could be a pianist, but you better be a Chopin, right? you better not go out there and you know, just learn chords. I want you to be good at it, right? Whatever you do, you have to excel at it, right? That means you have to grind and you have to put in work, you know, because look, I was told not to do what I'm doing now. And I'm grinding and I'm putting in work, and I feel like it's paying dividends. Now I'm able to live from jiu-jitsu, travel, see the world, compete, and raise my family, right? Like, bro, I leave my son at school and I pick him up every day. Most fathers don't get that chance, you know? Unless you take like a 5-6 month hiatus from work.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, if you're working a 9-to-5 or
you're not dropping them off, or you're not picking dropping them up.
You're not picking them up.
Yeah.
And the worst part is you're paying like $1,100 or $1,200 in daycares and shit like that every month.
For someone else to raise them.
For somebody else to raise them, dude. And they're going to come home with all sorts of other problems, things that you're not going to agree with because they're raised by another person. Think about how ludicrous that is, right?
Yeah, that's the rat race.
That's the rat race.
Over time, like as we've become more productive, you know, as we've like become more productive with access to technology, and as we've become more productive with mm-hmm. access to better communications, we've all become more like we're producing more, you know?
Yeah.
You would think the workers, like the actual people, would get some of that back in the form of like time off. You know, 40 hours a week is a long time, man. That's a hefty tariff, man,
and that people want out of you. I know people like in state jobs and stuff like that. I know there are a lot of jobs out there where, I mean, I don't think, quite frankly, that you need a 40-hour week. You could probably get a 30-hour week. And yeah. I'd venture to say that some of that could be done at home. I'd like to see more jobs, entrepreneurs that tell their workers, hey, man, you know what? At my job, you're going to work sixes every day. And then you're going to also work one day from home and, you know, and do a study what productivity is like, you know,
yeah.
like, am I getting the same results?
Yeah.
Am I, you know, if I inspire maybe a little bit more unity, right?
Yeah.
Within their own environments, their own immediate environments, right? Their micros, then is my productivity going to go up? But I think 6 hours that you're going to work,
I want to see this, right?
I want this type of productivity from you. You know, man, if I was faced with a job like that, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're still in the workforce, you could appreciate this. If you were told by a boss, hey, look, I'm gonna make you work sixes.
Yeah.
You could do your job at night if you want. You could do your job during the day, but this is the productivity I want during the week, and I'm going to give you one day to work at home.
Right? Oh, man, life-changing.
That would be life-changing.
Life-changing.
That would be amazing. Think about it. You could drop
It's kind of what I have right now, actually.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I recognize that some people don't have that. It's just like,
yeah, oof. Man, those Japanese, they work like crazy.
That's those crazy.
Guys work like crazy. They work like 10, 12-hour days every day on the regular, six days a week, right? Yeah, things run very late there. As a result, you know, it's crazy how hard they work.
Yeah, they have those little capsule hotels. They don't even get to go home. Sometimes they just like
get to go home. Yeah,
stay in a bunker.
Yeah,
go back. That's rough, man. That's so crazy.
It's crazy. Look, I mean, like for what it's worth, I'm very happy to be here in the States and very happy to have these opportunities that you know, give me a trajectory where I can, you know, I could be the person who I want to be with my family, you know, I can see my kids and, you know, it's not without its own problems. God knows I have administrative issues and I get injured or
anything.
All the hell because I had a shitty training session, but dude, I get to see my family, you know,
and
I get to raise my kids. My baby's right now is 5 months.
Oh, good
for
you.
I see her all the time. I get to wake up with her every day. That's amazing, bro. That's amazing.
Very cool.
So I can't recommend that enough. If you're out there, if anybody's listening to this and you guys are out there and you're contemplating maybe a jump, a leap of faith.
Do it.
Do it, man. Do it. Try it. You won't know until you try it. You know, it sucks. You might lose a little bit of money. I would recommend doing it well. Save some money before you do it, right? You might take a pay cut. But man, living happy, there's incredible peace of mind in knowing that you're doing something that you like to do for a change.
I'll bet. Very cool. Let's leave it on that. Thanks for coming on, brother.
Dude, you're the man. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.